Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. The world's media is focusing a lens on Chile with the expectation that those 33 trapped miners will be freed as soon as tomorrow or Wednesday. And the miners are reportedly jockeying not to see who will be the first to get out, but who will be the last. Rescue crews have finished lining the top section of the escape shaft with metal tubing to prevent further rock falls, and the capsule that will carry the miners has been tested. They've been trapped underground since the mine collapsed August 5th. The BBC's James Menendez joins us from the San Jose mines. And James, we hear quite a bit of hubbub there. Is that the world media that we are speaking of?
Yeah, that's partly the case. I'm talking to you from the gate to the San Jose mine, and it is a flurry of activity. And partly that activity is to do with the rescue vehicles coming and going, carrying equipment, carrying people, carrying fuel into the mine as the rescue operation really gets into full swing, those final stages. But it is, of course, the hundreds, possibly more than 1,000 journalists that have descended on this patch of the Atacama Desert to witness those miners coming up, which, as you say, we're told is going to be Wednesday. Could be earlier, could be a little later. Depends on how things go today.
Of course, family and friends are gathered as well. What is the plan for the order in which they will come out? We understand each rescue will take about 20 minutes. It's going to be agonizing, I'm expecting, but what is the conversation about the order?
Today they're going to name the four miners who will come up first. They will be the fittest and the most technically able, because obviously they want people who are in good physical condition to go up through the capsule first, but they also need people who are technically able in case something goes wrong, because this capsule does have a way out. If it does get stuck in this very, very narrow shaft, they can pull a couple of levers that will release the top, and then they can be winched down back to the shelter from where they came. Then the most vulnerable, those with perhaps pre-existing medical conditions, one of the miners, for example, has diabetes, some are suffering from high blood pressure, and then the rest of the group will come up afterwards. But as you say, we were told that they're all fighting for that last spot. Some suggested it was because they wanted to be the miner that held the record for being trapped underground the longest. But the health minister told me, look, actually, it's about the sort of brotherhood that's built up between this group. You guys go first. I'll be the last one. I don't mind staying down.
Right. Well, and what are the concerns, other than the one you just mentioned, that, you know, such a thin shaft and it may not come up through it?
I think it's going to be a very grueling ordeal. Although it will only take 20 to 30 minutes, it's going to be in pitch black. It is incredibly narrow. We're told that the rescue capsule will move at around the pace of a slow elevator. It'll come up the 600 metres, and the miners will be monitored all the time, but it is going to be very testing for them. They're worried that some of, especially the younger ones, may have a panic attack. They may faint as well. And in fact, on that issue, they're going to be wearing special suits, effectively, including socks, a bit like the ones you might wear on an aeroplane to stop getting blood clots during a long flight. But that will also cover their abdomen to keep their blood pressure up, because they need to be conscious throughout this journey up to the surface.
And is this going to be visible?
There's certainly going to be one television camera pretty close to the point where they'll come up. We think at the moment that we will get pictures of that moment when the first miner comes up to the surface. And then when they finally emerge from the rescue shaft, they're going to be taken straight to a place where they'll be given a very quick medical checkup. That's before they then go to a temporary field hospital that's been set up by the entrance to the mine. They'll be given more thorough checks there. And then we're told they'll be able to meet 2 to 3 members of their family. And then, if necessary, they will be taken to the hospital in the nearest town. I think all of the miners will end up there, because obviously they want to keep an eye on them for 48 hours or so. And then will come another ordeal, which will be facing all the questions about what happened to them from the world's media.
Just give us the thumbnail. What are the overarching questions about the mine that have been kind of lost in this?
The basic point is that this was a terrible accident that should never have happened. And also, in particular, what happened very early on. You'll remember that, of course, contact with the miners wasn't made until 17 days after the rock fall that trapped them underground. Everyone wants to know what it was like when they were on their own.
The BBC's James Menendez speaking to us from the San Jose mine in Chile. James, thank you.
My pleasure.
Last spring, during a tax protest in Washington, a group of Tea Partiers, most resembling older tourists, crowded into an auditorium as young conservative activists exhorted them to become community organizers. Uh-oh, groaned someone in the room. I mean, after all, community organizers, aren't they communists? No, no, said the 28-year-old libertarian running the seminar. We don't like that term because now we have a community organizer-in-chief, meaning Barack Obama, who got his lessons from Saul Alinsky. I say let's read Saul Alinsky. Let's read Rules for Radicals. Let's use it against them. That scene is from reporter Kate Zernicki's new book on the Tea Party, and it demonstrates the unlikely embrace by Tea Partiers of the same man who inspired Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, the man called the father of community organizing, Saul Alinsky.
The moment I even look at a community, the establishment promptly reacts in fear, shock, hate, and begins to engaged in a campaign of vilification, denunciation.
Saul Alinsky. He was behind the organizing of meat workers in Chicago's Back of the Yards neighborhoods, blacks shut out of jobs at Kodak in Rochester, New York, or farm workers in California. And now, even though Sarah Palin so famously put down Barack Obama by referring to him as a community organizer, not someone with responsibilities like a mayor, Tea Party leaders are feverishly following his advice. So, who was Saul Alinsky? Author Nicholas von Hoffman worked for him for 10 years. His new book is called Radical, A Portrait of Saul Alinsky. He joins us. Welcome.
How do you do? Good to be here.
I'm fine. Well, you give us all these insights. He talked about how organizers would use a pipe because a pipe would give them time to think if they didn't have a response. All these little details that you give us. But just tell us, in general, what was Saul Alinsky like?
He was a delightful man. He was a very strong man. You always knew that he was the boss. On the other hand, he always wanted you to say what you really thought. He could not stand flattery, and he had a wonderful nose for it. He was a man with a great sense of humor and a lot of imagination.
Well, and the image that goes out about a community organizer when the word is used disdainfully is sort of this wild-haired, wild-eyed communist. And by the way, was he?
Oh, no. He couldn't stand them. As he used to say, the reason I'm not a communist is I have a sense of humor. No, he was anything but.
You describe Saul Alinsky as a guy who approached this like a business, suit and tie, hair in place, and rejecting almost the sort of hippie-esque side of the equation that would emerge in the 50s and 60s.
Well, look at it this way. If you are a person of no or very moderate means, and somebody knocked on your door looking absolutely hippie-like, that person would look to you like a loser. And the last thing you want to do if you're organizing people, particularly poor people, people who are hard up against it, is to look like a loser. They've got plenty of losers all around them. And one of the things about Saul, which is very important, is Saul liked winning. He could not stand moral victories.
Well, some of the things he said to you, you organize people so that they throw you out. You don't get arrested. You let the local people do that. People have to have skin in the game. He described his work to a meeting of the National Conference of Catholic Charities in St. Louis in the 1950s, and here's your quote. Nights, days, meeting in homes, lodge halls, church meetings, persuading, persuading, and persuading, and a constant fight against apathy and the feeling of anonymity of we don't count, nobody cares for us, and there isn't much we can do about it. What kind of advice did he give you when he sent you out to do that, to sit in those meetings?
Saul did not have a method. What Saul had was, first of all, go out, find out everything you can about the people that you hope to work with, and learn enough so that you do the things necessary to bring those people together into an effective organization. But he did have certain rules of tactics in organization that make very good sense, such as, do not get your people thrown in jail unless you have a way to get them out of jail, because they have families, they have responsibilities. You can't do that with your people. Things like that.
Well, he sent you out, but he worked behind the scenes. He was an agnostic Jew, but had friends in Chicago's Catholic Church who saw his work for the poor as being Christ-like. They gave him generous funding, but then once they helped him win rights for the largely ethnic meat workers, they closed ranks when he tried to also include blacks, which seems to be a continuing theme of his. You know, that you can organize people, but you can't control what they do with their power. And you write, Saul Alinsky also got to know a lot of gangsters, like Frank the Enforcer Nitti, one of Al Capone's henchmen, because he worked as a criminologist in the Illinois prison system before becoming a community organizer?
Yes. Before he was a criminologist working for the state of Illinois, his PhD topic was organized crime. So that he spent a great deal of time getting to know all of these guys. He had the place wired.
Well, what did he learn from them?
What he learned was that they were running a public utility, as he put it. He had this description of going up to Capone's headquarters at the Lexington Hotel on South State Street, and he realized that this was like the electric company. You know, this was another big corporation. It was a corporation selling goods and services that were not legal, but for which there was a huge buying public.
Yeah. So as we said, this sort of reinforces this idea that Saul Alinsky approached community organizing like a business. And wherever he could, he got assistance. But then there were also the tricks that he pulled, maybe that you say, unfortunately, give some people the idea that he was more like a merry prankster. I'm thinking of his threatened fart in
the famous fart in Rochester.
Right.
Well, they were organizing the black community. Not only did they have the problems of segregation, but the largest industry in Rochester at the time, Kodak Film, would not hire black people. And it was also a city that had had a lot of very, very kinds of pompous, puffed out types who made a particular fetish of music. And the Rochester Symphony was very well known, etc. And one of the things that Saul was very good at doing was shaking up the other side, getting on their nerves, rattling them so that they would take a false step, which he could use politically. And so we purchased a large block of seats at the next concert of the Rochester Philharmonic, and we're going to do a music appreciation session by having a large baked bean supper before we get to the concert hall. And they just went crazy.
They gave in. The VP of Kodak cut a deal with Alinsky to bring blacks in, but then he was fired.
And that shows you the kind of stuff that we were up against. We had a complete deal. Then the people on the board said, no, we're not going to deal with those raggedy persons of the wrong color. So they fired him, tore up the deal, and we had to go to war again.
Nicholas von Hoffman, author of Radical, A Portrait of Saul Alinsky, who had 12 rules for radicals, including, if you push a negative hard enough, it will become a positive. Now, unions use this, loudly demonstrating until companies violently crack down, which then won union members sympathy. We'll have more on Saul Alinsky with Nicholas von Hoffman. Also later, the USS Cole crew 10 years on, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide. On the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation about Saul Alinsky, the man called the father of community organizing. He died in 1972 and left behind the book Rules for Radicals, in which he explained a lifetime of organizing to improve living and working conditions, tactics now being embraced by Tea Partiers. Remember in 2009 when people began popping up at those town hall meetings, shouting down lawmakers? Then a memo surfaced from a Connecticut conservative coaching Tea Partiers to carry out one of the Alinsky Rules for Radicals. Pick the target, freeze it, personalize it, polarize it. Use the Alinsky playbook of which the left is so fond. Well, we're talking with Nicholas von Hoffman, who worked alongside Alinsky. Nicholas's new book is called Radical, A Portrait of Saul Alinsky. And Nicholas, you say Alinsky might have been sympathetic to at least the Tea Party language, as you characterize it. You know, people who feel things are done to them by an elite, people against the bank bailouts, for instance. But reporter Kate Zernicki, who's going to be on the program on Wednesday, reminds us in her new book about the Tea Party that, according to a New York Times CBS News poll, Tea Partiers are more likely to describe themselves as well-off, to make over $100,000 a year, you know, not super wealthy, but not the penniless people Alinsky aligned with. And yet, you say you saw signs he was branching out.
In the last years of Saul's life, he was increasingly aware of the pressure on the middle class. He foresaw the kind of decline in the position of middle-class people, and I think he would have been in the thick of that.
On the other hand, you also say he might have been thrilled to be at any part of the election of the country's first black president, and we've also seen, you know, pictures of Barack Obama with a Hitler mustache, and one wonders if that could be because of the rules 5 and, I believe, 10. 5 is ridicule is man's most potent weapon. Rule 12, go after people and not institutions. One wonders if Tea Partiers are picking up on his direction in doing that.
First, I would say, and I know Saul would say, listen, getting a crayon and drawing a Hitler mustache on anybody is not ridicule. It's kindergarten stuff. And obviously, he would have no sympathy with the sentiment behind that. You want to personalize the enemy whenever it's possible. You don't want to get up in front of a group of people and say, we are going to fight the forces of history. To begin with, you can't negotiate with the forces of history or with a trend. You have to find people that represent what you are against, whom you can ultimately, you know, negotiate with, come to grips with. So you have to find a person or persons. And often you have to make them into villains. You just do.
But you made a point there that the whole goal of organizing and going through all of these rules is to get to the point where you sit down with someone on the other side of the table, and you have to leave room for that.
Always. You know, Saul always said, remember, you've got to leave a back door for the other side to get out of. You do not want to trap your opponent because you trap yourself. He thought that people who said, this is a non-negotiable demand, were crazy.
Well, a couple other things you say that he might be doing now. He might have been assembling a squad of 60 or 80 top-flight organizers to move into a small-sized city devastated by unemployment, to organize the community, to do something that it would get everybody's attention, and that he would totally reject the divisive use of ethnic or religious divisions.
He had little patience for that. To begin with, you know, he lived through that part of the 20th century where he had seen what the consequences of highlighting these divisions are. He did not believe that any good would come of that. So in that respect, I think he would certainly have saluted Obama. You know, when Obama has said over and over again, there's no blue America or red America, et cetera, et cetera. There's just America. And I think Saul really believed that profoundly.
Yeah. A couple other observations. He said of both Martin Luther King and Cesar Chavez that they made mistakes, which is a, you know, tough thing to be critical of King, but they made mistakes and that they made themselves in part the story. His whole point is that the organizer should be the one you don't even really know about. It's the people who should be up front.
Without denigrating the important role in history that Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. played and still plays, there were some things that he was extremely bad at, and one of them was organizing in the sense of leaving anything locally behind that was at all permanent. That was something that he did not do. He did not really build organizations. He built sentiment. He built a great, strong social movement, but it did not institutionalize in an immediate sense in the lives of ordinary people in many ways.
Well, Saul Alinsky died of a heart attack in California in 1972. After also just very sad personal stories. His first wife died after rescuing their child from a lake. The effort killed her. Very sad, and other sad personal stories. But, you know, a guy who just what? What was it like to walk into a room with him with movers and shakers? What was it like?
Well, it was fun. because it's sort of as though you'd walked into the room with Attila the Hun. And people get nervous, people get scared, it's very funny, and people make mistakes. One meeting with Marshall Field the Fourth at a club in Chicago.
From the wealthy newspaper family.
And in the era when the newspapers still counted. And this man was the proprietor of the Chicago Sun-Times, and Saul got into something with him about it, and Field was yapping on for a while. It was more than Saul could take, so he looked at Field and he said to him, listen, Marsh, you take that newspaper of yours and shove it up your ass. And then he walks away and then he turns around and looks at him and points a finger at him and says, and make that the Sunday edition.
Okay. Nicholas von Hoffman, author of Radical, A Portrait of Saul Alinsky, the original community organizer. Now it's something that's taught in schools. Nicholas, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it was fun. Thank you for having me.
And we'd love to hear your thoughts. Just go to hearnow.org, especially if you are a Tea Partier newly infatuated with Saul Alinsky. Let us know. Hearnow.org. Back after the latest news. Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England, and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on the Boston waterfront. Discover the power and beauty of new art and ideas, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it may be a holiday for many, but an opportunity for politicians out stumping for votes with the midterm elections just 22 days away. The president today dialed down on his language, but still suggested that Republicans are trying to steal the election with secret special interest money, possibly foreign money, a suggestion that set off a firestorm of criticism and may be a topic in some crucial debates coming up this week. Rick Klein is senior Washington editor for ABC World News and host of the ABC News Washington Post political webcast Top Line. And Rick, I misspoke. It was this weekend that the president sort of dialed down on these charges. But the Democratic Party has a pretty strong ad out saying of the Chamber of Commerce that it appears they've even taken secret foreign money to influence our elections. You've been fact-checking this.
Yeah, it's a pretty astounding charge. And what's interesting here is that the White House and the Democratic Party, they don't have any actual facts to go on this one. They are unable to cite any specific items here. They are saying, of course, we don't know where the funding sources are, in part because of the court ruling that President Obama and others have criticized. But they aren't able to say that, yes, there are definitely foreign dollars that are funding it. Clearly, the Chamber of Commerce and many other groups take money from foreign sources. But that's different than saying that they're specifically funding attack ads. The Chamber of Commerce says that's not true. The White House says the burden of proof should be on them. But as of now, no one's got any proof.
Okay, well, we'll see how that unfolds. Meanwhile, Democrats are also pointing to the case of Rich Ayotte. This is the GOP nominee for a House seat in Ohio. It turns out that he participated in Nazi reenactments with a group devoted to, you know, the elite Nazi divisions that he was wearing the uniforms of. Now, he has said, well, you know, people do military reenactments all the time. How's this unfolding?
Well, Nazis and campaigns rarely mix well,
yeah.
And I think it's one thing you get with some of these neophyte candidates that are out there. Democrats are publicizing this quite a bit. He also said that, yes, this was just a reenactment, but he's always had respect for the military achievements, just the strictly military achievements in Nazi Germany. So these are the kind of things that if it's someone in your party that's saying, and it's hard to endorse and hard to own it. I think the bigger problem for Republicans is if voters start to associate things like this with other candidates who've said they dabble in witchcraft, for instance, and they use this to paint a broad brush for Republicans this year. That's where it's problematic.
Well, the New York Times is reporting today that Republicans may win big in gubernatorial races. Right now, I think the divide is 26 states have a sitting Democratic governor, 24 have a Republican. And Republicans think that they can really change that equation big in places like Iowa, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Then you have Republican candidate Carl Paladino. He was on NBC's Today Show today, trying to clarify remarks about homosexuality. He told Orthodox Jewish leaders this weekend that he doesn't want children brainwashed into thinking that homosexuality is acceptable. Now, he has a gay nephew.
That's right, and he said his nephew has told him that homosexuality is not a choice, but he says personally he's not sure. He doesn't think he believes that. What's interesting in part is the setting. This was a small, intimate group. It comes in the wake of a terrible anti-gay crime that took place in New York City just in the last couple of days. So for
horrible. We should say a man lured into a building and horribly tortured.
That's right. And so for the timing is striking a lot of people as suspect. Clearly, Carl Palladino has run to the right here. He's a conservative. He says these are views that are in line with the Catholic Church. But there's another level of the way that he's jumping into this debate that I think is striking a lot of people as odd.
And I just briefly want to touch on Massachusetts. Oh, boy. Let me try to put this in a thumbnail. We have a sitting Democratic governor who's running. His treasurer is running as an independent. And then you have a Republican running. Now, the independent is accusing the Republican Party of infiltrating his campaign to support the Republican. Meanwhile, one of the accused says, no, the independent was actually working with the Democratic governor, although the accused waited a long time to say that. But it's a mess. And some are saying that it all might help sitting Democratic Governor Deval Patrick.
That's my sense, is that all of the if voters kind of tune out all this controversy and see this as just a big political mess, it takes Charlie Baker, the Republican candidate, down a peg, and it may help the incumbent Democrat because you have a lot of people who are just disaffected and upset with politics, and they'll take a look at how things are going and say, we're not so bad with this guy.
Well, we got some debates coming up this week, including in Delaware and Nevada. Something tells me we will be talking with you again. Rick Klein, senior Washington editor for ABC World News and host of the ABC News Washington Post political webcast, Top Line. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
And when we come back after a quick break, we're going to hear from crew members of the USS Cole. What was that like trying to keep that ship afloat 10 years ago? That's in 30 seconds, here and now. Ten years ago tomorrow, the USS Cole was refueling in the port of Aden, Yemen, when two al-Qaeda operatives steered a small boat alongside the destroyer and blew themselves up with a blast that tore through the ship's hull.
We had atomized fuel in the air. We had cables arcing and sparking. It was right out of a movie.
Well, it wasn't a movie, of course. That was Robert Overturf, a lieutenant aboard the Cole, who survived the blast, but 17 sailors didn't, and dozens were critically wounded. For 3 days following the attack, the Cole's crew struggled to free their shipmates from the wreckage and keep the ship from sinking. America Abroad's Jordana Gustafson spoke with crew members from the Cole about their ordeal and has this story.
Executive Officer Chris Peterschmidt had to get his wits about him fast. Peterschmidt was second in command on the Cole, and he had urgent and competing concerns.
We had to cut power to those cables. We had to get firefighting foam onto those puddles of gasoline. We had to make sure that all the hatches and temporary bulkheads that we could create were stopping the flooding from progressing into the rest of the ship.
Add to that, Peterschmidt feared they might still be under attack. He ordered crew members near him to break out their weapons and set up a security detail on the main deck. For the next 90 minutes, sailors worked to find, extricate, and triage 39 of their most critically wounded shipmates. When they ran out of stretchers, they pulled doors off hinges. To get the wounded off the ship, they used the backside of a ladder. They rigged ropes to slide them down to the pier.
And then once the wounded were taken to a medical facility, the marathon started, and that was really trying to stop the spread of damage.
They had to stop the spread of damage that threatened to sink the ship. But the Cole's main repair locker was destroyed. Further complicating things, the ship's communication system was down. And with more than 50 sailors wounded or missing, the Cole's chain of command was disrupted. For 3 days, crew members worked round the clock to shore up the ship and keep it from sinking.
Fighting that damage became for us fighting those unseen terrorists who had caused the situation we were in. For us, our battlefront was stopping that water from coming in. And we would go to the maximum length possible not to give up that fight.
Below deck, temperatures reached 130 degrees. Food and water were in short supply, sleep was scarce, and hygiene was poor. And the specter of their dead comrades, still mangled in the wreckage, hung above them.
But at third night, the crew was really starting to get to a point of just extreme fatigue.
But their efforts were paying off. Peter Schmidt, as well as the Cole's captain Kirk Lippold, felt they had made serious headway in stabilizing the ship. Engineers got one of the generators to work, and they were successfully pumping water out of flooded spaces. Peter Schmidt and Lippold ordered some of the crew to sleep. Chris Regal was hull technician second class. He sat down on the flight deck.
Just trying to relax and take a break and just gather my thoughts, and then that's when it happened.
Then the call comes out.
Robert Overturf.
Flooding, flooding, flooding. We've got flooding.
The one surviving generator had stopped working. Power to the ship was cut, pumps shut down, water rushed in.
And all the progress we had made in the 2 days beforehand almost all but evaporated. And so we're at that ragged edge of, in our minds, losing the ship.
The Cole's last engine room was filling with water. Peter Schmidt ordered a bucket brigade. Crew members waded into flooded compartments to find and plug cracks.
You literally had to put your hand against the wall that was had water on the other side, feel around to find those cracks that were now developing, and then plug them literally in the dark, knowing if that bulkhead that you had your hands against gave away, you would not have much chance of survival.
Crew members determined there was a crack in the shaft seal between a room known as Ox 2, which was completely flooded, and Main Engine Room 2. They used anything they could to plug the crack, but the water kept coming. Chris Peterschmidt used the one cell phone on board to call Commodore Jim Hanna. Hanna was in a hotel room in Aden, where he was coordinating the U.S. military's rescue response.
So I was trying to articulate and describe our situation, and he had asked me, you know, point blank, are you losing the ship? And to say the words, you know, for the first time, that yes, that we're at risk of losing the ship in a matter of hours.
Senior officials debated ordering the crew off the ship, but Peter Schmidt argued against it. To allow the Cole to sink to the bottom of the harbor would be to concede defeat and to fail their missing and wounded shipmates. Instead, they decided to do what to many seems unthinkable. On a ship that was sinking because of a hole in its side, they decided to make a second hole just above the waterline. Robert Overturf.
Cutting the hole in the side of the ship to pour water out is, no, that is not standard dewatering procedures or damage control procedures.
For one, it was risky. Sparks from the torch could ignite fuel in the water. So who would actually burn the hole? Hull technician Chris Regal volunteered.
And he did so while everybody was holding their breath that a fire wouldn't immediately start because of his cutting.
A fire did not start, and crews immediately ran the portable pump's hose through the new hole. The pump began to expel water out the side of the ship, and the water level held steady. Regal climbed out of Main Engine Room 2 and sat on the deck. An officer handed him something he'll never forget, a cold drink and his first hot meal in 3 days, Chili Mac. 19 days after the Cole was attacked, 4 Yemeni tugboats towed her out of Aden's harbor.
I'll always remember that, feeling the waves again underneath the ship, feeling the ship rock as it left the harbor. For a ship that was so close to physical death, it seemed now to be walking again and moving and doing those things that we became proud of.
As the Cole left the harbor, patriotic music blared from her speakers. Captain's orders.
And then a song came on that was not in the program. And I think a member of our crew had slipped this song in.
It was American Badass by Kid Rock. American Badass. Most of the song had played before Chris Peterschmidt could turn it off.
But I could tell that song of defiance, of defeating what we thought, you know, were the terrorist goals, really resonated with the crew. And I could see it in their faces, you know, that this song represented best what they had experienced and their fighting spirit.
The Cole was ultimately placed onto a heavy lift ship and transported to Pascagoula, Mississippi, where she was restored to full working order and redeployed in 2003.
I'm an American badass. Watch me kiss. You can roll with rock or you can
see you.
I'm a portal flick.
Well,
This epilogue, after the attack on the Col in 2000, the Clinton administration considered missile strikes against al-Qaeda's camps in Afghanistan but did not take military action. Although Yemeni courts tried and convicted two of the men involved in the plot, their sentences were reduced and they were later released from prison. The alleged mastermind, Abdul Al-Rahim al-Nushiri, is being held at the U.S. Detention Center at Guantanamo Bay. 8 years after his capture by the CIA, he has not faced trial. Our story on the USS Cole was produced by Jordana Gustafson for PRI's America Abroad. It's part of the radio documentary Remembering the Cole. To hear it, go to our website, hereandnow.org. Before we go today, remembering the late Solomon Burke, big man, big voice, big legacy. In a minute, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Today we're remembering one of the greats of soul music, Solomon Burke. Solomon Burke didn't mind that people he influenced, like James Brown or Marvin Gaye, were better known. His hits were covered by the Rolling Stones, Tom Petty, and the Blues Brothers. Here's his original version of their hit, Everybody Needs Somebody. Solomon Burke was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2001. Musicians like Bob Dylan and Elvis Costello wrote songs specifically for his Grammy-winning 2002 CD, Don't Give Up On Me. In announcing Solomon Burke's death at the age of 70 in Amsterdam, his website said that from day one, God and gospel were his driving forces. And critics say it was Solomon's early recordings for Atlantic Records that began to make the distinction between gospel and R&B, making it into something that was to become soul.
When your baby leaves you all alone and nobody calls you on the phone, or don't you feel like a cry? Don't you feel like a cry? Well, here I am, honey. Come on, you cry to me.
But Solomon Burke ventured into country music as well. He dropped by our studios in 2007 when his CD Nashville first came out. It features stars like Emmylou Harris and Dolly Parton.
Yesterday must be forgot. No looking back, no matter what. There's nothing there but memory that brings sorrow.
To mark Solomon Burke's passing, here is that 2007 conversation. And we understand that you've loved country music since you were a kid. Who'd you listen to?
Gene Autry, Roy Rogers. That were my two favorites.
Herb Jeffries?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Black Cowboys. Yeah. What were the songs? I mean, what pours back to you now?
The most songs that always last in my mind is, which my still wake up song is, I'm Back in the Saddle Again.
Really?
You know, and Happy Trails to You. And, you know, these are things that you remember as a child.
We mentioned that, you know, Herb Jeffries was one of the first Black Cowboys, but what was that like for a Black child to be sitting and listening to those songs? They were yours too.
I didn't know what color they were. And you learn as you grow older the difference in color and race and all those things, which now as time returns to itself, we're learning again that we're human beings.
Let's listen to some more of that soulful country flavor of Nashville from the new CD. Here's That's How I Got to Memphis.
Oh, she gets mad and she used to say she'd be coming back to Memphis someday. That's how I got to Memphis. That's how I got to Memphis.
I'm thinking that's such a more pared down sound than, let's say, Kenny Chesney, you know, Stars of Today. In fact, I almost feel like I can hear the room you're in, which I kind of like. You know, I can hear it bouncing off the wall. What were you thinking when you made this sound?
We were recording this CD in the home of Buddy Miller, and he's turned his home into a studio. So from the front door to the back door, every room is recordable. And you can just start singing when you want to and just start recording, and the engineers are all the way in the back kitchen, and just enjoy yourself and have a wonderful time and feel relaxed.
It sounds it, which sounds great.
It's just real. It's just natural and just at home, you know.
Remind me never to go visit Buddy Miller. Make it recorded. Well, you know, and we mentioned, you know, the impact of country on you when you were young. And you did record country songs early in your career when you were working with the legendary producer Jerry Wexler. He helped shape Aretha Franklin's sound, some might remember. What does country music say, the same or different from soul music?
Well, soul music is what you make it, you know. You put the soul into the music. It could be country, it could be pop or rock. It's the soul inside of you that's developed into the music or whatever that you're doing, just like yourself. You're a soul announcer. You activate the soul within you that brings that feeling out that's very special.
I'm going to have to keep that in mind. Solomon Burke, boy, in reading up about you, quite a Renaissance man. You are a businessman as well as a musician. You own a chain of mortuaries. You're a bishop in the House of God for All People Church, father of 21 children, a full life. And I'm thinking, grist for a lot of songs?
It is my life. Basically, gospel is my roots. The church is my roots. And from there, everything else is the foundation of the family. I have 21 children, 14 daughters, 7 sons, 85 grandchildren, 17 and a half great-grandchildren.
A half on the way?
Yes, waiting for the answers. And we just pray and thank God for every moment and every second, and the experience of life becomes a blessing along with each lesson.
I mentioned you're a bishop. Do you do the whole pulpit? I mean, are you at the pulpit? Do you testify?
Every day. Every day I'm on the pulpit. I'm on the pulpit right now.
Well, we want to hear some more from the new CD. Here's Up to the Mountain with Patty Griffin.
Some days I look down and I'm afraid I'll fall. And though the sun shines, I see nothing. Telling me softly, you love me so.
Back to your soul legacy. You've seen, you know, boy, a lot in your long career, but I'm just thinking recently, James Brown just passed, Wilson Pickett last year. You know, some would say you are the keeper of the soul music flame.
Well, I'm trying to do the best that I can. There's so many great artists out there that are singing soul today that it's just very exciting to see.
Yeah, who do you like? Who?
I like, of course, Beyonce and Usher and
John Legend.
Oh, yes, just amazing.
Yeah.
And every day, I mean, you see new faces and new people doing new things and greater things and sounding good. You know, it's just, it's wonderful.
We've been talking to Solomon Burke about his new CD, Nashville. But I just want to mention, again, the other CD that we mentioned, in which artists, you know, legendary artists paid tribute to you, wrote songs just for you, Dylan, Van Morrison, Nick Lowe. They wanted to shine more of a spotlight on you. What did that mean to you that they did that?
It's a very wonderful feeling. I'm still very graciously thankful that we had the opportunity to do it. And so many artists are, you know, given these great accolades after they're gone. And I'm very grateful to be here to meet Elvis Costello and sing with these people and just sing with the Rolling Stones and do all these great things we had the opportunity to do.
Yeah, we were talking the other day about Sister Rosetta Tharpe.
Oh, amazing.
Gospel, blues, amazing, rock and roll guitar
amazing,
player.
Yeah.
Died unknown,
yeah.
Buried in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
In an unmarked
amazing,
grave.
Yeah.
Yeah. So Solomon Burke is here now to hear
from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
From Philadelphia,
yeah.
As well,
yeah.
To hear how people feel about him. And that's got to be a good feeling. Solomon Burke, thank you so much.
Thank you.
So glad we caught that. Our conversation with Solomon Burke in 2007. He died of natural causes yesterday in Amsterdam. He was 70 years old. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young. Join us again, Here and Now.
My sisters and brothers, because if you do, you can hear their voices still calling.
across the years.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.